We've been disconnected for almost 100 years as Native people. We commonly call them the buffalo, scientifically known as bison, but we, in our Lakota language, would say Teoyate, the Buffalo Nation, or Tatanka. We're out about reconnecting Native people with their four-legged relatives.
Radio Netherlands presents Buffalo Nation. The program is presented by Martha Hawley.
You know, we had a pact with the buffalo. Our legends talk about the buffalo helping us to come out of the earth, which was under the ground, and it was a safe place for us, and we were very afraid of the surface world. And the buffalo was already there. When the buffalo observed us coming and going, you know, going back at night, coming up for a short time, the buffalo said, I will give you food, I will give you clothing so you can be warm. I will give you my flesh to eat and to survive. And when I am in need, then you must help me too.
Rosalie Little Thunder is an enrolled member of the Sichanghu Lakota Band. She lives in Rapid City, South Dakota, on the edge of the Great Plains and next to the Black Hills, the sacred center for Lakota people. The Lakota belong to the Great Sioux Nation, the largest and most powerful tribe in the West in 19th century North America. As Europeans moved west, the buffalo were almost wiped out on the Great Plains, and Native Americans were driven out or onto reservations.
I mean, here is extreme violence. And for people not to think about what the buffalo's role was in the ecosystem, but to very carelessly kill so many, I believe, for the hides, but also to cut off the food source for the Lakota, who would not surrender or be confined. You know, the armies very deliberately cut off the food source. And so it was in the interests of control of the Lakota that the buffalo were decimated. Here's the buffalo, who is considered a very central species of the ecosystem, who created habitat for other species, who carried seed in his coat, who ingested and passed seeds to spread the plant species around, who churned up the earth and fertilized it. And there are even people who said the massive herds would stimulate the rise of the water tables to bring more water to the surface. So if you think about 50 to 60 to 60 million buffalo suddenly being taken off out of the ecosystem, we had the Dust Bowl. And so the land got very sick.
That type of diet that was fed from the days that the buffalo were gone, it was a consistent diet, and generation after generation of Indians, their health continued to deteriorate. Their lifespan is 20 years less than the average male, white male in the United States. And in later years, as they finally started to recognize some of these things, the federal government was very slow in responding. They just started in the last 5, maybe 10 years to improve the quality of food that was distributed on Indian reservations. And even today, the food that they continue to give is still unhealthy. I mean, you would think that somewhere someone would wake up and realize that if they start giving out good, healthy food products, that in the long run it would not only save money but save human suffering. And so, you know, the federal government is fully to blame for the epidemic proportions of diabetes on Indian reservations.
Mike Fox is from the Fort Belknap Reservation of the Gros Ventre tribe in north-central Montana. Buffalo meat is low in fat and cholesterol, so Mike Fox and his partner Susan launched the Indigenous Diabetes Education Alliance, IDEA.
all you have to do is look at a box of commodities, which are the food distributed each month to Indian families that choose to participate. And, you know, we're bombarded in the news and on TV, you know, low sodium, low fat, and, you know, they spend millions of dollars on ads for everybody to eat healthy, but yet you look at a box of commodities and you pick up just one can and you read the sodium content, and what they're asking Indian people to put on their table is more sodium in that one serving at that one meal than they're telling the rest of the non-Indian community in the United States to eat in a day. By reintroducing buffalo into the diets of Indian people, since we're not only going to provide for that diabetic, but for their family as well, we're hoping that maybe just by preparing that buffalo meat that night, the grandmother might tell a story, a buffalo creation story, that will encourage other people to remember things from the past. Just having the buffalo as a topic of discussion, maybe that provides some sort of hope.
In dealing with a lot of the problems of alcoholism, you know, drugs, gang-related activity, even back home on Fort Belknap, even a severe alcoholic that, you know, stops and visits with me on the street, he'll still ask me about the buffalo herd. I mean, there's still a very strong connection there, even though that, you know, he might not be in the best of condition, that his, it's still there. And so we're hoping, again, as Susan said, we're hoping that just bringing that back around the table again will help a few people out there.
South Dakota may rank as one of the nation's youngest and least populated states, but its history is as robust and exciting as any state in the Union. From Lakota chiefs, French fur traders, and prairie...
Official tourist information takes a detour around life on the reservations. But times are changing. The white population on the Great Plains is decreasing, and the Native American population is on the rise. And South Dakota is now the largest bison-producing state in the country. On the Great Plains, the profound silence is disturbed only by the peeping of cell phones and prairie dogs and the hum of the bison caretaker's truck or van. One of the largest tribal herds is on the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Reservation. Fred DeBray has worked with the tribal herd and now has time to stand watch over his own. So what does a rancher see?
I'll just see a few buffalo kind of hanging out, wondering what's up. If they were trying to get out this fence over here where there is no fence, then I probably would have to chase them back over here under my property.
What would be a reason for them to chase you?
Just because I'm trying to chase them.
What happens in a typical chase?
Oh, we just chase each other around till we get to where we want to be, you know. I mean, if I want them to go east and they want to go west, then sometimes I have to pretend that I want to chase them west. And then they chase me east instead. And they get over east where I wanted them to be, and they chase me out of the country, and we're both happy and everything's cool.
Have they ever caught up with you?
Not yet.
Buffalo need room to roam, and protecting the land base is an ongoing struggle for most tribes. Based in Rapid City, the Intertribal Bison Cooperative pools efforts by dozens of tribes. DeBray is the director.
I just figured buffalo was one of the things that had all the elements that were necessary for everybody in the reservation to be part of, and I thought if anything could hopefully turn things around, it would be buffalo, because they're powerful enough to accomplish that.
What do you mean by turning things around?
Well, turning things around is kind of seems like we've been standing still, perhaps even going backwards in our development. So I think that part of that was because of the we never really dealt or healed from the past, the events that took place, all the Holocaust and all the things that were imposed on Indian people. And so we're still hurting from all that stuff. And so I figured we need to get back to the roots and the basic causes of those things and deal with them and heal from them, and then we can move forward.
And you also said that it would be a tribal herd would be something that would be to every tribal member's benefit. In what way?
Well, you have to understand the politics of the reservation. We're not Democrats and Republicans like the dominant society. Here we got traditional people and we've got some more progressive kind of people. So some don't want to see progress and technology and all these things. They want to stick to tradition and try to maintain values and culture and that kind of stuff. Others are kind of figured, well, we got to put that aside and just be more progressive and get into economic development and do what we got to do. And which both of those are true. I mean, we have to do both. And so in my view, I thought that Buffalo was the only thing that I could see that it could accomplish both. It allows for the economic development to take place by building up a large herd of buffalo, building up a meat market, for instance, a market for the byproducts. All these different things could create a lot of job opportunities, could restore health back to the people, could do a lot of different things from an economic standpoint. But it also could do a lot of things from a cultural standpoint.
Our whole purpose of raising buffalo is to bring back more of them in the numbers. When we started raising buffalo, there was only something like 280,000 buffaloes in this world. Today, there's almost 1 million buffaloes. So we're playing our part to bring them back. And yes, we have enough buffaloes to sustain the family for the year. Sometimes my wife has a giveaway ceremony, and this year she did, and she gave a live buffalo away to another Teoshpaye so they can start their own herds. And so we're doing our part to bring back the buffalo.
Families and community groups are starting to build their own small herds, one buffalo at a time, in this case, on Pine Ridge Reservation.
Well, my name is Alex Whiteplume. I'm the leader of my Teoshpaye. My Teoshpaye means the extended family of my brothers and sisters. And each one of us own, within our Teoshpaye, we have our own intimate families. But a Teoshpaye basically is a corporation. And the only difference from an American corporation or any other corporations is when we create economic development or we get any money, it's distributed equally amongst the siblings, my brothers and sisters, but it's all geared at the family, the Whiteplume family. Lakota, they call us the Wachihinska Teoshpaye. Within our Teoshpaye, we have our own police force, we have our own maintenance people, we have horse masters, we have people who maintain our park. Some are into herbs and medicinal medicine that just grows wild out here. So within our governing system, we have a government, we have all the ingredients. We speak our language. We have a land base. We have a police force. And so we meet all the essentials of being a sovereign nation. Yet we are stuck in the middle of America where we're not acknowledged.
You have your family organization, the tribal government, and the U.S. federal government present in some way. Can you try and describe how those worlds meet when you're living on the reservation?
We are declared as Americans by Act of Congress in 1924, but we never really choose to be Americans. There was an Act of Congress that created these tribal councils, the modern Indian Reorganization Acts, and they're the only ones that the United States recognized, but this was created from their Congress, their government. So we have that to contend with. And the third option is that we're Lakota, we're within our kinship. We know our family. I know who my grandfathers are. I knew who my grandmothers were. I know where our history came from. So there's three different lives that we live, the federal level, the tribal, modern IRA level, and our own Teoshpaye. And our people live in all three levels. Some chose to live as Americans, red, white, and blue, Chamber of Commerce and apple pie. That's the life they decide to live because it's open to them. And some are just stuck as they're called progressives. They live with the modern IRA government. They know how to live within that system. And here in my family, we chose not to live in the other two worlds. We chose our own world as Lakota. We're allies of the old ways and we'll never, ever forsake that.
Traditional, progressive, and non-Indian paths cross in new ways all the time. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe now has a mobile processing machine. The unit is a unique adaptation for buffalo of Swedish field units for reindeer and caribou. Tim Pickner knows the job.
Actually, we can start right here at the processing unit. We're hooked up to a three-phase electricity right now, but we can take this unit out in the field. That's what it's designed for. It's a stress-free unit. You take the machine to the animal instead of bringing the animal to the packing house. So the meat's a lot tender. It ain't stressed out or nothing. It's calm. It's standing out there. We go out and shoot it while it's grazing. So here's the generator that operates this machine, and both trailers have generators.
But it's huge. So how does it move?
It's two semi-trailers. Hook up to a tractor trailer and pull it. The best way I can describe this unit, it's a transformer. If they know, they ever watch them cartoons, you know, that they fold up, or the cars, this is like one. This thing goes up and out, and it's all hydraulic. I mean, we can go inside. I'll let you take a look and see what the unit's all about. Okay? It's bigger than it looks than the outside. So we got a locking room. Okay, we're in the back section of it, and this is where the buffalo comes in. We got these hydraulic doors, and we'll hook up the hind quarter there, and we'll bring it in upside down. We'll bleed it right here. This is the bleeding section where we're at, and this is where the head will come off. The carcass will go up this conveyor here. The hide puller will start pulling the hide off. I mean, it'll peel off real easy. Then once we get the carcass up to the gut table, all the guts will drop down here. We'll split it in half. Hind quarter will slide down on the rail, and we have it swinging in front of us. Then we'll quarter it, and we'll slide them into the cooler.
We have buffalo kill ceremonies. Before a buffalo's life is taken, you have to ask for permission. You have to ask for forgiveness. You have to ask the buffalo to surrender itself. And first time I saw it, I thought, this is really odd. Second time I seen it, I said, coincidence. That's how the human mind works. It kind of rejects the spiritual things. Tries to make sense of it. We try to make logical sense out of it. But, you know, I've seen it so many times now that, and I feel it. You go to the herd, you say the prayers, and one emerges and presents himself to the person with the bow and arrow or the gun or whatever. You know, when you see that so many times, you thought, these buffalo know what's going on here, and they've heard your prayers. And so it's really emotional. It's very hard to participate in these kill ceremonies. And people who are around buffalo, the herd managers feel it too.
Normally we like to do it early in the mornings. We usually contact a medicine man locally, and then he'll come out and they do prayers. They pray the four directions, and then one of the buffalo will give himself to the people, because that's part of the prayers, is they ask the buffalo nation to come and help feed the people. So a buffalo would come out from the herd and come to where the people are, and then the individual will harvest the buffalo. Pretty powerful to see something like that.
Chuck Bulbear is an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and director of the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. We drove out to see the Rosebud Sioux Tribe Buffalo Project, and just in time, as it turned out.
Okay, we're at the main gate going to our buffalo pasture here. We're probably on the southeast corner of the buffalo pasture. Honeybee.
Honeybee?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the main entrance?
Yes, it is. I'm going to show you something. There's a buffalo right there along the fence. You see it? See him?
I do. I thought that was a buffalo, but then I thought, no, I'm hallucinating. No. It's a water tank.
No, it's a buffalo. He's standing right there. Actually, I think he's outside our fence.
So what can you do about it?
I'm going to get a hold of some help and have him come in here and chase him in. I'm sure he found a hole somewhere. I think it's trying to get back in by following the fence. He's probably missing their herd. Let me get hold of some of the radio. W4, W1. W4, W1. W5, W1.
Go ahead,
W1. So you want to head back there. We got a buffalo that's out here. He's just about 200 yards north of the main gate here. He's working his way this way.
10-4, we'll be there in 15 minutes.
They're on their way. Actually, I should open up this gate. He might walk right in.
You're going to open up the gate, and he's going to, you think he might just run right over where we are?
Yeah. He might come over here and just, like I said, see the gate open and just walk right in.
Here he comes.
He doesn't seem to be limping or looking for anything that's injured, but he's walking pretty good. So I don't think he's injured. I think he's just looking for the herd.
The front of the buffalo is so big, and the back is so small.
It's what they call their cape, where their fur is at. That's the biggest part. And up front there, you know, there's a lot of muscle up there. You know, they need that for survival and to be part of the herd, to put their pecking order in their herd. You know, we want people to know what we're doing and how it goes, because Hollywood stereotyped the Indian as being savages and just running amok, but we're not that way. So, you know, we like a lot of people to come in and to see what we're doing.
W5, W1.
Go ahead. 10-22, I roped the buffalo and drug him in, so you don't need to come out here.
10-4.
Now go ahead.
You get a chance to stand on a windswept river bluff or watch a herd of bison grazing in a sea of open prairie, do it. Think back and ponder how challenging life must have seemed to men sent to meet unknown people and to explore unknown lands. Think of it.
If you ever looked at the herd characteristics and lifestyles of bison herds in larger free-roaming situations, they do take care of themselves. They take care of themselves as relatives, as family units, a strong social structure there. We also know that somehow intuitively when they are sick, can take care of themselves with certain herbs, certain grasses on the lands. They know when it's time to move on. And they've exhausted and again, not wiped out, but maintained a balance with the environment around them. They, if they have the opportunity, they will move on.
Phil Baird is a Tsuchanghu Lakota from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He works at the United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck, North Dakota, where he tackles bison restoration in the academic world, even though he describes himself as an old Lakota, a broken-down bronco rider.
One of the distinctions that we've come to understand between bison caretaking and animal production of domestic animals is that in Western thinking of animal production, you wean, cull, and get rid of the older ones when they're no longer producing. Well, in the bison world, we've come to understand you need to keep the elders in the herd, because it's the elders who teach the little ones how to be the buffalo. And we've seen research where you've taken calves, young buffalo calves, take away the elders, and they truly have the potential to become domesticated and just become large horned humpback cattle.
These values shape bison management courses at native colleges. The Oglala Lakota College on Pine Ridge Reservation does field work with a local herd, the Knife Chief Community Buffalo Project. Trudy Akofi is head of their Agricultural and Natural Resources Department.
The course itself wasn't new to the fact that there have been bison on the Pine Ridge Reservation for, I think, since the 1930s. But what was new is the idea that these animals have to be confined now, and now we have to readjust our thinking on how to work with these animals to make them culturally or ecologically stable to their environment.
How did you do that?
I based it off of some of the curriculum that I know of that for cattle management, cattle livestock. So I took some of those components and put those, so we know that we need to learn about disease and feeding the animals and breeding and reproduction and those kind of aspects that are livestock. We also knew that these were considered wildlife. So then I looked at the wildlife components of elk and deer, and then some ecology type of courses with grass management, water management, and soil, plus the cultural components, which I had a lot of help from like the Lakota Studies Department, and then the marketing aspect, business as part of that as well. So students can learn how to at least make them sustainable animals that if you get into the business or working with these animals, that you can also be able to make enough money to take care of those animals. And there's all kinds of different ideas out there, and we try to bring those out to the students and then have them come up with their own conclusions. If they had a herd, what would they do?
The bison networks continue to grow in ideas and action. The Buffalo Field Campaign sends volunteers to danger zones to protect buffalo who may wander out of protected pasture land and get killed. In the winter months, it's called Snow Watch, and that's when Rosalie Little Thunder wears white.
My best advice to management is non-management. Just protect them from people. You know, keep the people out so they don't get hit by traffic or get shot by people who get scared of them or whatever. You know, if I had it my way, I'd have buffalo all over the plains.
Buffalo's mentality is they're really intelligent. They're not really afraid of anything. They don't have any natural enemies. And it makes me feel good. In the wintertime, you can find them on the coldest day, might be 100 below zero, wind chill. They'll be up on the top of the tallest hill just playing in the cold. Don't bother them at all. And you'll find cows down in a deep draw somewhere, out of the wind, huddling together, shivering. And you just look at the difference in those two different animals and the attitude that it gives you. I mean, if you get around them cows, next thing you know, you're feeling all cold and shivering and very depressed and thinking how cold it is. And then you get up on the hill with the buffalo and they're all playing and jumping and kicking around, and makes you feel like throwing your tail up and kicking around a little bit too and kicking your heels up. So kind of rubs off on you, you know.
One story I can tell right now is a woman, Indian woman, who wasn't taking care of her children and was brought into tribal court. And they examined her situation, single parent with kids, and she didn't grow up with the parenting skills. And so in a very interesting and yet culturally relevant decision, the judge imposed a sentence whereby this Indian woman would have to stay with the tribal herd for 30 days. And she was asked to record everything she saw. As the story goes, at the end of 30 days, she came away a very different woman who saw how the Pateoyate, the Buffalo Nation, took care of their own, and she learned how to be a mother, how to be a relative. And in this day and age, it's really important then that we pass that knowledge on to our children.
You've been listening to Buffalo Nation. The program was produced by Martha Hawley for Radio Netherlands.
If you'd like to comment on this or any other Radio Netherlands program, please write to us at the English Language Service, Radio Netherlands, Post Office Box 222, Hilversum, The Netherlands.